Hello, anybody else there? What is wrong? Hello? Anybody there? Hello?
Hello, anybody there?
Hi, I am. It's Candace.
Hi, Candace. It's Don.
Hi. Okay, so now there are two.
Okay.
And we're being recorded.
Good. Yes, I got that message when I logged on, so that's good.
Okay.
I noticed I'm on the ReadyTalk website as well, and it says that the conference, it says, please wait for the conferencing organizer to begin the meeting. So that implies that there's something that you haven't done. Now, you haven't muted anybody, have you?
I haven't what?
Muted. Yeah, there's various codes that you can use, to, and you can mute people. And let's see if there's a code to start the conference. No.
Well, I had to enter a password.
Yeah, I know that.
And it said so that it was going.
Yeah. Well, maybe this message is just a generic message then, but are you logged in on the web?
No.
Okay. Why don't you log in? Are you in front of your computer?
Yeah.
Okay. So go to ReadyTalk.com.
Okay.
And I
just got an email from Marge saying she is going to participate.
Good.
ReadyTalk. I spelled it right. Good. Control. Enter.
Now, I'm afraid. Oh, wait. Now I can do this, too. And I think there's a special way that you log in.
I think that's only if we want to.
We could text each other. And then,
okay.
Sorry.
So I can put in the access codes.
And your passcode. So type your passcode in there, and that starts the thing on the web. And I think it gives you a control panel as well.
Okay. logging in. Okay, to start a meeting, select it from the list below, and click
the only
open.
That can see that screen that you're looking at now.
Open meeting controls.
And so I suggest that you just enable everything. Now, I just got an email from you.
Yeah, just saying I'm on. Please,
oh.
Everybody, sit and see. The application's digital signature has been verified. Do you want to run the application? Well, okay. So I'm looking at a page that says "Ready Talk." Your meeting. Well, here, let's see. Okay.
Now it says here that please wait for. Oh, something is happening on my computer now. So maybe. But it
says, it's got a list now of me being here and you being here. Ah, someone else is coming in.
That's me, Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi, Michelle. It's Don.
Hi, Don.
Are you over your sickness, Michelle?
I think so, yes. Most
good.
Definitely. I'm off the antibiotics, so technically I'm now well. I'm still coughing, but that's okay.
Okay, so we have Phil, Michael, and Marge. Esma is not participating.
Okay.
So sometime, Marge, I'd like to talk to you about the email you sent. I'm sorry, I'm just back from my trip and I'm not, you know, caught up. But you sent me the email about the stuff you've been doing with Marge's data. So that would be good.
Okay, before we talk about that, I'm seeing that please wait for the conference organizer to begin the meeting. And so there's something you need to do, I think, Candace, on the website there to begin the meeting so that people can use the website.
Start web conference?
I think that might do the trick.
You may need an optional security code. Your participants will be required to enter the security code to join your web conference.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe we can't use the web.
Yeah, I think that I had to do something. I had to take some... someone else is here.
Hi, it's Phil.
Hi, Phil.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
So Don's here. I'm here. Michelle is here. That leaves us with two to come. So, yeah, I think if we're going to use the actual website, which we would only need to use if we were going to show things.
Well, no, I was on the understanding that we could text each other, and that might be useful from time to time. But if we don't, it looks like we don't know how to do that.
No, and I'm pretty sure that Jean told me that I had to... hi, here's somebody else.
This is Marjorie.
Hi, Marge.
Hey, Candace.
That sounded like two people came in.
Yeah, Michael, did you come too? I don't know. Let's see, I've got...
Hello? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, is this Michael?
No. Hey, it's Michael, yeah.
Okay, good. That means that we are all here. I think for the future, if we want to use the website, I have to do something. I have to go through some training on the web. But what I do know is I can't close this down because if I do, it's already told me that it will end the conference call. So
I think you should just leave it alone now.
Okay.
What did you have to do on the web?
If we want to use the web part of the conference
thing,
ReadyTalk, then I had to take some kind of training and I didn't do it. Because we had said we weren't going to need this, so.
Right.
Okay, so I think we're all here, so take it away, Don.
Okay. First of all, I'll tell you a little bit about my motivation here, because I didn't make that clear in the memo. My motivation is that my intuition said that change scores are okay, and also they're easier to understand than analysis of covariance. And the Smur report suggested that they're okay, too, under certain conditions. But they were a little vague about what they mean. They said that they're okay if the slope of the regression of the post-test scores on the pre-test scores is nearly equal to unity. But what does that mean? That's rather vague for a bunch of statisticians to say nearly equal to unity. So I think we owe it to the statistical education community and other education communities to say whether the analysis of change scores is permissible and how the approach compares with other approaches in terms of power. So, as I say in the memo, I think we'll find that they're permissible, although we may find that they're a little less powerful than analysis of covariance. And I think that the simulation will generate a journal article, and I think it'll be accepted a statistical education journal if we write it carefully, because we can say there's controversy about change course, and here's our answer to the controversy. And I think we can give a fairly definitive answer as to whether change scores are acceptable. Of course, maybe we'll find that they're not, but I suspect we'll find that they're okay. In terms of software for the simulation, I'd originally thought of doing a simulation in SPSS, but I now think it'd be better to use R, because everyone has access to R for free, and fewer people have access to SPSS. And as you may know, you can actually call R from SPSS. So those that do have SPSS can call R if they want to. I think what we should do is write a rather thoroughly documented R program that's modular, and we could, of course, include a link to the program in the journal article. And this would allow other people to use the program and to modify or change the distribution that we use for SAT scores to the distribution that's exhibited by the test scores for the tests that they're interested in. And that way, anybody can repeat the simulation with their test distribution and decide whether change scores are valid for their particular type of test. So having said all of that, I think that it's time for other people to talk a little bit. And I'm anxious to hear criticisms or suggestions for improvements to what I'm proposing. So what do people have to say?
You know, if I can chime in, I would say, you know, Don, this is a great memo that seems like a lot of work that has gone into it, which is fantastic. You know, it's really well laid out. I appreciate that. Can you step us through the memo and just kind of give us an overview of your thought process? For me, that would be helpful to do together, and then, you know, we can discuss issues afterwards.
Okay.
Is that of interest to the group?
Definitely. That sounds good.
Okay, I'm pleased to do that. I assume then that people have the memo in front of them.
Yes.
And I guess the first thing I talk about in the memo on the first page is that it makes sense in discussing this that we just talk about value scores, because otherwise it's a little confusing what we're talking about. So we're talking about the value scale on the SATs, and we want to know if teaching approach A, we have two teaching approaches that we're wanting to compare, and we want to know if teaching approach A is better than teaching approach B at improving students' scores on the SATs value scale. I think the first issue that I talk about under our change scores of valid measure is something that Candace raised, and that has nothing to do with the simulation, but it has to do with if you measure change in a scale score and compare the change between two groups, is that a sensible, reasonable thing to do? And I explain why I think it's sensible in the memo on pages, I guess, two through, I'm going a long way on that.
Mm-hmm.
Five. And I think the bottom line here is that I can't prove that they're acceptable, but I think the onus falls on someone who believes they're not acceptable to say, well, wait, here's an alternative explanation why change scores don't work. And you might get a difference between teaching approach A and teaching approach B and change scores, but this could be explained by such and such. And I can't think of any alternative explanations. If we find that on a particular pair of teaching approaches, that teaching approach A improves change course better than teaching approach B, then I can't think of any other explanation, and if everything is done properly, of course, I can't think of any other explanation but that teaching approach A is better at improving students' perception of the value of statistics. So that leads me to think that it's sensible to say that analysis of change scores is valid in the sense that comparing them between the groups is valid. That's not to say that we won't get statistical problems out of analyzing, but that it's valid from a theoretical point of view. Does anybody want to comment on that? Candace, you were the one who thought that it might not be valid. Are you still feeling that way?
Sorry, I just tried to move down in my screen and it changed screens. Okay, there's a couple of things, but I don't know if this meets Phil or Michael, whoever suggested you go through the memo first. If they really want you to go through it and then we talk about it, should we just keep going? Or do you want feedback?
I'm easy either way. Shall I keep going?
I would say keep going.
Okay. So,
and maybe we can make kind of either a physical or a mental note of what are the areas that we want to discuss afterwards.
Good idea.
Okay.
Good idea. Okay, so that's my argument. In a nutshell, I can't see anything wrong with this from a theoretical point of view, not a statistical point of view, but from a theoretical point of view. It makes sense. Now, just to back up a bit, if we find that in one group change scores get better, just in one group between the pre-test and post-test, we can't conclude much from that. We can't value scores get better, not change scores, but if value scores get better between the pre-test, conclude much from that, because it may be the case that there's some effect that naturally predisposes scores to get a little higher at the post-test. But if we find that there's a difference between teaching approach A and teaching approach B, I don't think that there's any other way of explaining it, assuming that value scores are valid. I don't think there's any other way of explaining it but that teaching approach A is better than teaching approach B. All right. So on page 5, I digress a little bit to talk about the use of p-values, just because there's controversy now among psychologists, and I know that we have some people in our group that are interested in the psychological side of this. There's controversy now among psychologists about the validity of p-values, and they recommend maybe that people use confidence intervals. And I'm suggesting that it's reasonable, because people have been using p-values for years, that we shy away from that controversy and assume that p-values are sensible here. And so, going to page 6, I propose the simulation. And basically, I'm saying that we don't need to think about hierarchical models here, because we can assume that teaching approach A and teaching approach B are being taught in computer-aided instruction, so there aren't any teacher effects that we have to worry about. And so we can just do a standard analysis without worrying about a hierarchy. Later on, we might want to simulate teacher effects, but at the present time, we can just do a simple simulation without that. And so it's basically a matter of generating data for, say, two courses with 30 students in each course, and either there's a difference in the change scores between the two, or there's not. And of course, if there's no difference between the two groups, then the p-value for the difference should have a uniform distribution on the 0-1 interval. And if there is a difference in the two groups, then the p-value should be a little lower, with the preponderance of the, falling less than the median between 0 and 1. So basically, we would generate these scores for a large number of trials, shall we say, perhaps 10,000 or 100,000 or a million. And then we would look at the distribution of the p-values, both in the case where there is a difference between teaching approach A and teaching approach B, and where there's no difference between the two approaches. And, of course, we should get a uniform distribution if there's no difference and if change scores are valid, and I believe we will. And we should get this preponderance of p-values less than the median if there is a difference. And, of course, we have to find a way of doing some appropriate statistical tests to see what's happening to the distribution of the p-values, and I suggest one binning approach with a chi-squared test as a way of doing it. That's a kind of a common way for testing distributions, but somebody might be able to come up with a better way of doing that. We can easily do this in R. I just ordered a book about simulations. I'm not that familiar with R, but I think it would be a good language to use because it's easy for anybody to download it for free.
Right.
And if we write the simulation with lots of documentation inside it, then it would be easy for anybody to modify it.
Can we just take a point? Who has used R before? I have.
I have.
And
I have not.
Too, but I'm most familiar with SAS and fairly familiar with SPSS. I'm less familiar with R.
Is Michelle on the call?
Yeah, I use S+.
S+ and R, same thing, yeah,
yeah.
Essentially.
Well, they don't always perfectly move across, but mostly they do.
Right, but I think if there's a simulation that we're creating, I would assume that it would be done the same way. Anyway, they should be similar enough that it should be a small learning curve.
Yeah.
I think so, too. So, is there anything else in the memo that needs to be covered? One other thing is that we do need to make sure that the distribution of the value scores is the same as the distribution that the actual value scores have. And for that, Candace suggested that we select from the SATS master file all the introductory statistics courses that are in the file, which probably are about 80 or 90% of the courses in the file, and base our simulation on the distribution of the SATS value scores in those courses. Of course, we can do the simulation for SATS scales as well if we want to, if they have different distributions. So does anybody have any questions about all of that?
So it seems to me, this is Michael, it seems to me that this is the right structure for a simulation, the idea of saying, okay, let's pretend that we have, 60 students in the intro class, 30 in each class, and look at what scores they might get, and then look at the impact of analyzing with change scores.
Yes,
right?
And compare that, of course. I don't think I said this, but we would also analyze them with analysis of covariance.
Yeah, so the questions to me, I guess I'm envisioning this as, what are the attributes that we're setting up or that we're varying in the simulation, and then what measures are we using to do the analysis? So, for example, I think the ANCOVA, I guess, doesn't make sense unless we're putting in covariates in there.
Well, this
But I would think that we would want to look at the change scores, maybe the percent changes, and the stupid naive approach of just looking at the post scores and ignoring the pre completely. And then look at, in the simulations, we should be able to show that the post analysis is not good.
We can do that.
The change scores would be good.
I don't know if it's worthwhile doing it, because everybody knows that the post analysis isn't going to be as powerful.
But I find in simulations, when I had done, too many hours of them on my dissertation, showing someone the obvious gives them more belief in the credibility of the simulation itself.
And it doesn't cost much.
Cost much.
No, once we
generate
it, it's just a matter of separate little sections of code for each analysis so that we can do a whole bunch of analyses.
And R is good for modularizing that.
Yeah.
So, and then the other thing I would say is, the other thing I would be interested in looking at is not, are change scores good, but to be able to better answer the question of when are they good. So my vision is to have, what I was just thinking right now is, if you imagine kind of a 3x3 matrix where the horizontal, where one axis is the pre-score and one access to post-score. And the three values in each one are kind of low scores, moderate scores, and high scores. So you have nine cells. In the first cell, the scores started off low and didn't increase. In the second cell, they started off low and became moderate. In the third cell, they started off low and became high. Moving down to the second row, they started off moderate and reduced to low, et cetera. And so I would ask the question, under all of those conditions, you know, when there's a large change, when there's a small change, how strongly do change scores show you this versus, you know, percent change versus something else? And so I feel like I would want to be able to answer the question, not are change scores good, but, you know, under all of these conditions that we've tested, when are they good, when are they not good? You know, what if we have some of these strange anomalies that I think Marjorie could describe for us very well of, you know, what's really do we see going on in the data? Can we actually assign those to occur in our data and then tease out what could happen when, via a simulation, we know what the truth is?
I think that's very reasonable, Michael. I like that, although I would say that the simple approach is just to duplicate what we see in the SAS master file. But there's nothing
wrong. And then if you were to do that, what's your one- or two-sentence summary of what we found, assuming we find something? Well, how would you summarize what we found in terms of writing a journal article?
SAS, or at least analysis of change scores, is valid, and relative to analysis of covariance, the power is such and such.
For showing differences between two treatments.
Yeah, for showing the difference between two treatments. We're not really interested in much else. Or no, I shouldn't say we. I'm speaking for other people here, but I'm not interested in much else but comparing two teaching approaches, because I think that's really where the money is. We want to find out what is the best way to teach statistics, and we need objective ways of comparing different approaches. And the change scores are a simple way of doing it. I'm not sure they're as powerful as analysis of covariance, but if they're valid, we should say they're valid rather than letting a myth be perpetrated that they're not, or that some people think that they're not valid. Now, I'm not saying they are valid. My intuitions say they're valid, but I'm not sure, and so we'll have to show that in the simulation.
But all that it will say is it's able to show or it's not able to. Game scores are able or are not able to show if one treatment is better than the other.
That's right. That's
they
that's
won't
right.
be able to say by how much.
Oh, well, no, but
Yeah, you can't subtract them. I'm sorry, I just saw this today. I wrote an email to you. You can't subtract them unless you know that those change scores themselves are valid score measures. And as we talked about, the simulation is not going to speak to that. It can't.
Well, I agree fully with that. And I'm not... That's another problem, how you're going to talk about the difference. And the only thing I'm talking about here is not the difference, but is teaching approach A better than teaching approach B? That's all I'm trying to figure out right now. And then we can go on and use other methods to say how much better it is. But the first thing that has to be done from a scientific perspective is answer the question, is there a difference between the two approaches? And that's the what the method I'm proposing is attempting to do.
Don, could you explain how you're going to generate under the null hypothesis and exactly which two analyses you're comparing? I've got Michael's thing that we could look at a straight change or gain or whatever you want to call it versus a percent change and see what the differences are. But you say that you're going to generate under the null, and then you're going to compare it with having a covariate, but surely how you generate it will decide which approach is better. If you generate it so that the covariate plays a role, that method will be better. If you generate it so the covariate is irrelevant, then you don't need to include it in the analysis.
Well, the covariate will always play a role because the correlation between the pretest and the post-test will be roughly 0.5 because that's what we found with value scores before. So that if a person gets a low pretest score by the random number generator, then the algorithm will give the person a relatively low post-test score. And the algorithm will work so that the correlation between pre-test and post-test scores will be a half, roughly, whatever number we come up with that's more appropriate.
Yeah, but how are you going to generate the pre and post scores? If the post score is the pre plus the random error that ends up with that correlation, or is it that you're generating the pre and the post from something else, adding random errors to both of them? Are you going to make the post?
There is a,
you know, it's how you generate it will decide which method is most appropriate for analyzing it.
For the pretest score, of course, you'll use just simply use a random number generator and generate them with the distribution that we find in the pretest scores in the SAS master file. And then to generate the post-test scores, there's an algorithm for generating correlates that have a certain correlation coefficient, and I don't think I can get into the technicals. I couldn't begin to describe it right now, but there is an algorithm that will do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so under the null hypothesis that there's no difference between teaching approach A and teaching approach B, we just use the algorithm to generate all 60 scores, 30 from each group, exactly the same way, so that the post-test and the pre-test have the same correlation in both groups, and there will be no difference between the two groups. Now, there will be difference between individuals, of course, because different individuals will have different pretest scores so that they'll have the appropriate distribution of pretest scores, and different individuals who have the same pretest score will have different post-test scores because the algorithm adds randomness to that so that the post-test score isn't always the same difference from the pretest score, but there's a random component to that. But the algorithm will ensure that the correlation between the pretest and the post-test is about a half. Now,
but and are you assuming that there is no difference from pre to post, or what's the amount of difference that you're assuming there is?
Well, you have to do it both ways, of course. You have to assume in one part of the simulation that there's no difference and show that in that case, if you do analysis of covariance or if you do a change score analysis, that the p-values have a uniform distribution. On the other hand, if you generate the data so that there is a difference, then, of course, you expect in both cases, there's not much to argue about here, that the p-value is going to have a median that's lower than a half. And so they're both going to say, oh, there's a difference. What you're worried about is that under the null hypothesis, when there is no difference, that for some reason, maybe a regression towards the mean or maybe some other effect will cause the p-value not to have a uniform distribution if you're analyzing change scores. And then, of course, the whole thing falls apart, and we can't analyze change scores. But my intuitions tell me that the p-value will have a uniform distribution if there's no difference between the two groups.
But so I think, Don, I think your last point is a really good one.
I
think your last point is a really good one. You said if there's regression to the mean, then things will fail.
Perhaps
it will fail. It's something we might want to look at. But that is something that we would have to build into the simulation. Are we building in regression to the mean or not?
We need to know what the algorithm does.
Right.
Well, this is something I've been thinking about, and I'm not that good with simulations. My simulation I did for my dissertation, I generated my own data using a random number generator. But if we have these pretest and these post-test scores that are in the database, and if we make the assumption that we have, here's this population of, that we've got this population of pre and post test scores. And if all that I do is randomly, I'm going to have a difference, a population difference in pre and post. If I randomly assign them into two groups, those two groups should not be different.
Correct.
So is there something, and what I like about this is inherent is already the correlation between the pre and post. I don't have to artificially make it. It's the real ones is already there. And so I mean, I'm not sure what to do if there's, you know, how would you start dealing with, oh, there's a little bit of a difference in teaching method B. But I'm just thinking, if we have this population, you randomly split them into two groups, they, those, there should be no difference between these two groups. That could be one simulation. You throw them all back, you then randomly assign them into two groups, and you keep on doing that. I don't know. I mean, this is what
a bootstrapping approach.
A bootstrapping using the real data with the inherent relationship between the pre and post that I'm not sure that we could numerically generate.
Well, I don't have it right at hand, but I'm fairly certain that I can quickly find the algorithm for generating post scores that are correlated with the pre scores with whatever correlation we want.
Well, do you have the name of the R command that does it?
The name of the which?
You're going to do it in R, so you have a command that does this in R, or will you?
It should be a simple. I mean, all of the programs have algorithms that can do this. I think that is a detailed question that we can figure out, right? I mean, if you say that you generate the first observation, then you say the second observation has a certain correlation structure to it.
Yeah.
You can easily just generate the second number.
Yeah.
But you know, and it sounds like Donna said that 0.5 is the correlation that we're looking at based on the data. It sounds like we can, you know, if that's based on the past SATs data that we have, great. You know, I would argue that we might want to try changing that a little bit because that might not always be the case for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but so I guess my understanding of the purpose of the simulation is it would be to say, okay, let's assume that there's a correlation of 0.5 between class A and class B. Let's assume that there's no difference between the averages between class A and class B. Now let's think about simulation number two, a 0.5 correlation with a difference.
Michael,
of...
Wait, you're going at it differently than I am. I say that there's always a 0.5 correlation between pre and post.
Yeah. No, I was going to continue with that. So in the first simulation, there's a 0.5 correlation between pre and post.
Not between A and B.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah, I stated that correctly. There's a 0.5 correlation between
pre
and post,
mm-hmm.
and you assume there's no difference between A and B.
That's right.
The second time, you assume a 0.5 correlation between pre and post, but you also put in a 0.1 increase from between B relative to A.
That's correct.
Right.
In number three, you do a 0.2 increase. So now you're saying, okay, based on all of these, we can look at what the results are.
And so you're able to get a power curve in it.
Exactly. So my claim is that my proposal is that we put in not just what the increase is, but also what was the starting value. Did you start off low or high? Because if you start off high, you can't improve by that much. And we look at not only the change scores, but you know, the percent change, and look at, you know, which one of these methods are detecting the differences.
Well, I think they are.
Then we think about, I mean, the reality in looking at the results that Don put in the appendix, you know, if we want to make it like real data, we should think about what the missing data structure is. You know, now maybe that's a second paper on its own, but it's very clear to me from the data we have a number post that we don't have pre. So are we only looking at the, you know, the whole cases when we have both measurements? Well, we know that that's not going to be unbiased.
Well, I suppose we could look at the distribution of the missing, the students that have the missing post, and we'd probably find that they have lower pre's. And so if we wanted, we could eliminate a subset of the pre's that are lower to simulate the ones that are dropping out.
We can eliminate the post scores for the pre's that are low.
For some of the pre's that
right.
are low, for the
right.
dropouts. So, those things are sensible to do, although I recommend that we start simple and try to just simulate straight ahead what's going to happen, and then we can add extra wrinkles. We've got to get the thing working first.
But why is there a question of what's going to happen? Because if we're simulating it, we're going to force something to happen. or not happen.
The question of whether or not you will find the main question, which is implied by saying that change cores aren't valid, is that under the null hypothesis, you'll find a significant difference between A and B. Now, my intuitions tell me no way, but that's the only effect that could happen if analysis of change cores aren't valid, that you find a significant difference under the null hypothesis. And so that's what we're testing.
But how could we find a difference between A and B if we're simulating it so that there's no difference? I guess I'm just confused about
because
that point.
Because regression,
I don't think,
of course, the mean or some other effect causes it. Now, I fully agree with you, Michael, that there's no way I think we're going to find any difference between A and B under the null hypothesis. But people who are saying that change cores aren't valid have to be implying that.
Aren't they implying?
No.
It depends on their pre-score. And if you have generated your data so that your pre-score is it's affecting the increase, then you will find you need the pre-score when you do the analysis.
Well,
if
you
generated it so it
doesn't,
then you don't need it when you do the analysis.
I agree that we have to generate the pre. We have to say that the pre-score will affect the analysis because that's what a regression toward the mean is. But even if we take that into account, I say that I think there's no way that we're going to find a difference between A and B under the null hypothesis. So, yes, certainly, we have to take account of regression toward the mean.
But we're not doing a regression right now. That's why I don't have a sense of what we're doing with this data.
Well,
when we've got these scores and these differences, you're going to do a t-test to compare the increases under approach A with the increases under approach B.
That's correct.
That
however,
correct?
There still will be regression toward the mean in the generated data. Because we have to generate the data to simulate what typically happens with pre-post scores. And with pre-post scores, there is regression toward the mean.
And where is that in the simulation? Where are you putting that into the simulation?
Well, when you generate the data, you have to ensure that putting it simply, that the slope of the regression line is less than 1. Because that's what regression toward the mean means.
Okay. So we are constraining the data to follow that.
Yes. Yes, we have to do that. We have to simulate the data as they actually appear, so that we will look at the slope of the regression line from the SATS master file and make sure that the line has that slope, which will simulate regression toward the mean.
But if you take even multivariate data, the PCA line will go through the middle, like the axis of the ellipse, and then when you regress one on the other, it will move down towards the mean. I mean, that's how regression works.
It will regress down towards the mean?
Yeah, you know how the regression slope is always below the principal component line? It moves down. If you draw the ellipse,
that's
the
right,
principal
yes.
component goes along the axis, and then you take the two vertical tangents to the ellipse. If it's multivariate normal and the regression line goes through the line where the vertical lines make tangents on the ellipse,
it
pulls it down, right?
Yes.
And then if you regress from the other way around, it goes up the other way. I mean, that's a sort of an artifact of regression.
Yes.
So if you've generated your data multivariate normal, for example, that will clearly happen. You don't have to build it in. It would be there. But it's kind of how the data is generated that decides whether that happens or not.
Perhaps that's right. I'm not sure about that. But we have to make sure, the point is that we have to make sure that the generated data exactly simulate what we have in the SATS master file. And so that the slope of pretest versus post-test is going to be a little less than 1.
Why do we need to constrain it to what's in the SATS master file?
Because
I think those are good starting values, but I'm not sure why we have to constrain it to that.
That's all I'm saying, that we start that way.
Uh-huh.
Because we're trying to prove in the first instance that it's sensible to use change scores for analyzing SATS data. So we should generate our data to simulate SATS data perfectly. And then, of course, we can explore other things, and it's very sensible to explore other things, and it's sensible also to write the program so it's easy for other people to put other distributions in so that they can explore their own data, because we can't explore everything.
Don, could you explain exactly what you mean by change scores are valid?
Yes. There is a lot of talk in education research that change scores are not valid and must not be used. The SMER report says they're okay as long as the slope of the pretest on the post-test is nearly equal to 1.
But isn't that just saying that if not, you need to bring in the pre-scores as a covariate? It's like testing if they'd be in the model.
No, we're always taking account of the pre-scores when we do change scores. And there's two ways you can analyze them. You can analyze change scores, which takes account of the pre-scores, but not as a covariate, but through another means by computing a difference. Or you can do analysis of covariance. And there is a lot of talk in education research that analyzing change scores this way is inappropriate. And a lot has been written about that.
Yeah, but isn't that because the gain or the increase or the change is correlated with the pre-score? So that if you're only interested, and this has been an average change, you could go in and do, say, I'm just looking at one group now, just group A. Then you would go in and do your t-test or whatever, and you could test if on average there's any change.
The t-test that I'm talking about, you can't do with one group.
Let me go over. I'm only going to talk for one moment about one group. I'm not comparing two groups anymore. I'm just going to look at one group. And I want to know if their scores have changed from the beginning to the end. And
well,
in
that's
fact,
a completely different issue.
Okay. But if the analysis is relevant for one group, it would be also relevant when we're comparing two groups, and it's easier to explain it with just one group than with two groups.
Okay.
So if I have just one group, and I look at the changes in the scores, I don't know if we're going to even call them changes or gains or differences, because Bernatti seems to use these words in slightly different senses, but the post-score subtracts the pre-score. And if this difference is not correlated with the pre-score, I'm really happy that all you would do would be a t-test. If it is, my understanding is you can still do the t-test to see if there has been a change over the semester in these scores as we measure them, whether or not they're measuring what we think they're measuring. And it will tell you if there's been an average change. However, it's possible that that average change is because, say, the students with low scores have increased and the students with high scores have decreased. So you can find out about the average change, but you've lost a whole bunch of information, which had you included in the analysis, the pre-score as a covariate, you could have picked up. And if in which case, if taking into account that baseline score, which I know they do in a lot of clinical trials when they're comparing A with B, it should be there when we're comparing our A and B teaching methods.
See, and I agree with Michelle. I also agree with Don in this, but only that you can determine, and sorry, Michelle, I would rather stick with the one group thing too, but it doesn't work with one group for the reasons you just described. And that's what all the people in education and psychology, that's why they're saying do not use gain scores. I think what Don's simulation will show is, can you use gain scores to tell if treatment A or treatment B is better?
But
it can't tell you by how much. It doesn't allow you to do any, the gain scores don't allow you to do any kind of cost analysis, cost-benefit analysis. And so, for example, if I were reviewing an article where people used gain scores and told me that treatment B was better than treatment A, and that's all they said, I'd reject it.
Because you would want to know by how much.
Because I would want to know by how much. And
I'm getting a lot of beeps on my line, which I think is somebody trying to come in on my other line. I'll just go off and come back on. I think I can do that.
Okay.
I'll have to dial in again, okay?
Okay.
I'm just getting so many beeps, I can't hear you guys. Hello?
Yeah,
you're back.
Oh, I'm still in. Okay, then I failed to get this to whoever was trying to get in on the other line. Not to worry, I've still got you. And I haven't got any beeps, which is great.
Can I just for a moment talk about the fact that I don't think it's going to be that easy to get the parameters you need out of the master stats file? Don, you said that you thought 90% of the sections that are in there are introductory statistics classes.
Well, that was a guess.
Yeah, I think that that's way high. I haven't, you know, I took the information that Marge sent for the last two semesters, which are the two, about course characteristics and what departments they're taught in and what the prerequisites are and so on. We have several business courses. It's still introductory statistics, and they're not math or stat majors, but they are business majors. We have at least one graduate-level course in pharmacy that, again, is an introductory statistics course and so on. Even if we look, and this is on partially analyzed data, I'm sorry about that, but I spent some time on the first two semesters after we collected it. Some of those classes have a very much lower post-response rate than pre, even though I know those people didn't drop because we get grades. So if they give permission, either pre or post, we get to ask, Marge and I ask for the grades. So if there comes a grade and it's not a W or a drop or whatever, then I know they're still there. We have several sections that have bad internal consistencies.
Well, I think, though, that we just have to make do with what we have.
Well, but I think that we had better decide for sure. I mean, I think we carefully need to pick the sections that we use. And the other thing is that although, and let's look at the correlations. Yeah, I think probably pre-post correlation in value is about 0.5 under normal circumstances, but I think we should look at what we've got in these courses. I think we need to look at internal consistencies. I don't think we should use courses if the internal consistency on either the pre or the post value scores are low.
Well, that's why I think it's a benefit in doing the simulation to actually say, let's start off by assuming a correlation of 0.5, but let's throw in 0.3 and let's throw in 0.7, and let's show that our results are independent of the, you know, starting assumption about the correlation. Or how are they associated with correlation if they are?
I'm in full agreement with that because it's no problem to...
I'm sorry, I missed that last bit because my other call did come in. I think Michael was saying something. I'm really sorry. I missed, like, two sentences.
I was saying, you know, Candace expressed some concern about, you know, relying too heavily on the results from the SAS master file. And my comment is when we're doing a simulation, we don't need to rely on that at all. We
right.
can create all the structures of the data that we need. So if we think the correlation is 0.5, let's try 0.5, 0.7, 0.3, 0.6, 0.4, 0.9, 0. You know, let's try all those values, throw in that correlation structure, and then talk in the discussion of the simulation about how those parameters affect the outcomes.
Right, okay.
I'm in full agreement.
And I think that it would be important to do this. I just pulled up some correlations, like with cognitive competence, it's about 0.473 for one of my data sets. Difficulty was 0.4.
Across data sets, or I mean cross sections or within sections? Because it needs to be looked at within sections. Because that's how an experiment would be done. An instructor would have, you know,
well, the
two
point
sections.
I was trying to make was that they weren't all around 0.5.
Right.
Is that for the different attitudinal components that...
I think the one I've got is quite a bit lower as well, the one I've been playing with.
That some of the attitude... For the different attitudinal components, you're going to have different correlations. So the simulation...
Except that Don's talking about only value to start with.
Yeah, I'm starting simple, but I'm in full agreement with putting the whole thing in a loop. And looping through a bunch of correlations,
yeah.
Easy as pie.
I mean, yeah, I don't think it matters which, you know, component we're talking about, because the goal here is to show what's the impact of varying parameters on the inference using gain scores.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter whether we're, you know, using values from the value score or the cognitive competence or whatever. You know, we're just
except that I want to make sure that we simulate at in one of our simulations exactly what we've got on the SAT so that we can say either, yes, it's valid to use change scores to analyze SATs data or not. But apart from that, we can look at anything we want and vary things all over the place.
You know, again, I have a little bit of a sticking point for me is the statement that gain scores are valid. I mean,
they aren't.
For me, I don't have a problem, and I think we're going to be able to show gain scores are a valid measure if the true relationship is just an additive gain.
No, you're going to be able to show whether or not gain scores are valid for determining if treatment A or treatment B is better. That's it. The thing that educational psychologists and measurement people are hollering about gain scores isn't that situation. It's about the situation where you have pre-post.
Only.
It one pre-post, one course that you're looking at.
Yeah, I mean,
if you put two courses, this is
in my mind, those are different
because I only
problems.
Described for one group. But having explained what I meant for one group, I was then going to continue and say if we're comparing the two groups, and if, in fact, the increases depend on the pre-score, when you compare the two groups, you should include the pre-score. There's some fancy name for it when longitudinal things. I can't remember what they call it. In clinical trials, there's something about a baseline. Does that sound familiar?
Yes,
I'm sorry,
that's
I've not done this recently. And in which case, that pre-score should be in as a covariate. And the way we generate the data will decide if it should be there or not. If we generate it so that it's not relevant to the increases, then we won't need it.
We will always generate the pre- and post-scores, and we will always analyze the data with analysis of covariance, but we'll also analyze the change scores. And so,
but if you haven't generated your gains to depend on the pre-score,
yeah,
clearly the covariance in where you include it will be irrelevant. It will just be less efficient. If you've generated your data so that it's relevant, then including it will be more appropriate. And the way we generate our data will decide which method is more appropriate or more efficient. Or
well, I guess there's only one way to generate the data, and that is to simulate as closely as we possibly can what actually happens. Now, as Michael suggested, we can vary correlations and we can vary other things, but we want to make sure that the data have regression toward the mean and that they have correlations and distributions, because the SATs distributions are truncated at the upper end. We want to make sure that all of these things are in our data, so that the data will exactly, in one set of data anyway, exactly simulate what we get with SAT scores in an introductory course.
But I think Michelle's right, though, in that if we're saying there's a correlation, we need to make each generation of a post score not just, let's say, for example, a uniform random variable, but a function of the pre-score.
Of course.
But that's what I thought that we were doing. I guess I'm not understanding. I thought that we were going to take the pre-score, choose some correlation to whether it be 0.5, 0.2, to generate the post-score so that our data is going to have the post-score depending upon the pre-score.
Marjorie,
correct.
That's an excellent point, because that's the issue, that we have to make sure in this correlation that yes, if someone has a low pre-score, they have a relatively low post-score.
But my question is that, I suppose that correlation, our post-scores are going to be dependent on the pre-score.
Yes.
Through the correlation. Does that address Michael's and Michelle's issue? And that's what I'm not sure.
I think that it addresses it in the sense that we're going to make sure also that there's regression toward the mean. And so we're going to generate data that's exactly like real data. Then it's very important that we do that. If we don't generate data that's exactly like real data, we're not doing a proper simulation of the stats.
I guess.
So the issue that I think comes up with simulating quote unquote real data is we don't know what some of the underlying data structures are that exist in the SATs data.
Well, I think we know enough. We know the correlation, and we know the distribution of the pre-scores, and we know the distribution of the post-scores. And I don't know if there's anything more we need to know. Is there something missing if we know all of those features?
Yes. Are the increases or the gains related to the pre-scores?
Right.
But if we have a correlation of, say, 0.5...
But that's between the pre and post, not between the pre and the gain.
Oh.
She's talking about the gain
the
from
I know I'm totally failing to get this point over, but that's the one I'm not managing to get over.
Yes, it will be related to the pre and the gain, because the relationship between pre and gain is a decreasing relationship, and that's regression to the mean. So if we simulate regression toward the mean, we also simulate that decreasing relationship between pre and gain. A slightly, the slope of the line is slightly decreasing. And so, yes, we will be taking account of the relationship between pre and gain, the slightly decreasing relationship.
But there could be a decreasing relationship because it really does depend on the pre-score, in which case it should be generated like that.
Well, I'm suggesting that we're going to do that.
I think I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around exactly what the models look like. For me, it would be helpful if we could actually see what the models that generate the data look like.
I think that's a good suggestion. It sounds like I get to crack open some textbooks and figure out how to generate these correlated variables. And
well, I don't even need you to – I mean, for me, what I need, I don't know what everyone else needs, but what I would need to see is not the code that does it, but just written out the equations that are going to do it.
Sure. That's what I meant.
Oh, yeah, okay.
We have to ensure to keep everybody happy that we have that proper relationship between the pre-scores and the gain scores of a slightly decreasing relationship, which is the same thing as saying regression toward the mean. We have to make sure that we have the right correlation. And we have to make sure that the scores are truncated in the upper end, which is relatively easy to do because you just throw the high scores away when they're generated, I think. Now, it's 4:53 in Toronto right now, so the proposal was that we discuss in the last 10 minutes what we will talk about in the next discussion. But I suppose we don't have to stop right now. What would people like to talk about right now? Should we talk about the next discussion, or do you want to go a little longer on what we're talking about, or what?
I have no idea what happens at the top of the hour in terms of...
Well, I doubt very much that we get cut off, but it's, I suppose it's possible.
I don't think you do.
Next hour?
In my previous using of the ReadyTalk system, we've gone over an hour, and they don't cut you off.
Okay. I just know that what Gene said is there can only be one cluster conference call going on at the same time. There can only be one at a time. And so if there's one that's scheduled on the next hour, then I assume we'll get cut off. If not,
she's usually good about that. She probably would have warned you if there was one.
Okay. And the only other thing I need to say is I have a box on my screen that says the program has detected a network error. Please check your network connections. If the problem persists, you may need to restart the application. If that happens, this phone call gets cut off.
Yeah, I would leave that alone. I mean, in the past, we haven't, in the conference calls I've used with ReadyTalk, we haven't used that at all, and just ignore it because we're not really looking at something visually together. So I would say two things. One, I need to go at 5, so I can't stay afterwards. Three things, I guess. Two, I would pose the question, maybe we don't have time to talk through it, from Michelle. You're talking about using the baseline to generate the pre to generate the post?
I've been playing with Marjorie's data, and I've been generating under the null hypothesis numerous different ways, and I've done that for some of them and not for others, and then had a look at what happens.
Uh-huh. So my understanding is that the benefit of using the pre as a covariate rather than using the gain score as the dependent variable is the ability to model other covariates in the model. But if you're looking at a simple model where you're predicting pre from post, it doesn't matter whether you use the gain score versus the pre as a covariate to predict the post.
Except that...
No, I'm the other way around. I'm using my pre as a covariate. I don't really mind. It doesn't make any difference to me right now whether I'm using the post or the gain. So I just want to include the pre. And sometimes it's relevant and sometimes it's not, depending on how I've generated my data.
Okay.
But if you use the pre as a covariate, you get rid of the relationship between the pre and the gain score. You then have to worry about measurement error in the pre.
Right, but there's another...
You have to do that anyway.
But there's another benefit of using the pre as a covariate in that if you have other covariates in the model.
Right.
You can
use them
as either interaction effects, et cetera, with the outcome. And that's, you know, my understanding of one of the benefits of the ANCOVA model.
Yeah, I love
covariates. I guess, too, you can, of course, include covariates and change scores. So there's nothing that says that you can't use the change score as the dependent variable and yet still have covariates.
But the problem in doing that is that you cannot model an interaction effect with the baseline component if you're using the gain score.
I agree. And I think what we're going to find is that analysis of covariance is slightly more powerful. I think that's what we'll find, and therefore the analysis of change scores or gain scores is not preferred. But I would like to do this simulation because I think a lot of people are saying the analysis of gain or change scores is not allowed, and I think that's wrong. I think it's allowable, but just not quite as powerful. But now I'm not sure about that. And I'm just basing my assumption about the difference in power on what Peter Bonnet said in his book.
I've actually got quite lost. Would you be able to type up one more page, Don, explaining what you've just said? I think it's probably because it's the end of the hour. I'm just somewhere losing track of things.
What I just said?
Yeah, just the last couple of things that you were saying about, I don't know, gain versus post and covariates.
Okay, I think maybe...
I know the time's about to run out.
Yeah. Okay, I will... I think you're interested in, gain... Gain versus post. Okay, I'll talk a little bit about that.
Huh. So I'm curious if Phil is still with us, if he has any insight...
I'm still here. I'm just been listening to all the issues. I wish I had more time to personally read Don's memo. Right now, I have nothing really to add one way or the other. I'm more than willing to help out with any. I mean, the idea of doing simulations and writing any code for R, I'm completely fine with. I actually find that stuff kind of fun. So,
have you done simulations in R before, Phil?
I have. Mainly doing more bootstrap type methods, but still, simulation studies.
Have you used SAS instead for simulations, or what?
No, I've never really done SAS with simulations. Okay. Anytime I have to do anything simulation based, either for a class or for my own research, it was either S plus when I was in grad school or R.
Okay, great. So I guess the question is, where do we leave it? I mean, I need to leave. I don't know if other people want to talk for a while. But
I actually have a student coming in probably any minute now.
Well, we probably at some point do need to decide what we're going to talk about next time and or to continue this conversation.
I mean, in my mind, I think what we need, what I need, again, I don't, is understanding exactly what each model looks like and how the data are generated. I'm happy to do a small pass at that, or let Don do it, or let someone else volunteer for it. But at least in my mind, I think that's what I need to understand what the simulation is really doing.
Okay, well maybe
if I'm the only one for that, I'll do it for myself. But
no, I would agree. I'd like to see how this data is going to be generated, so that I can feel like, because everything with the simulation depends on how the data is generated. I mean, if you're having trouble with the assumptions and the way that the data is generated, that's crucial to a simulation.
Sure. Well, maybe, Michael, both you and I, because I'm surely we'll come up with different approaches, should write some material about how the simulation would work.
Okay. Do you want to do that in parallel, and we can kind of submit both to the group and talk about them all and...
Yeah, we could later maybe merge them, or we might decide that we disagree and go separate ways and do separate simulations.
Right.
But it makes sense to each of us do them separately to start, because presumably we'll both come up with some good ideas.
Right.
Okay. Now, shall we propose that the next phone call take place, and we've been going roughly one a month. So maybe we would, Michael and I would submit something before the next phone call, and we might talk about that. Is that reasonable?
Mm-hmm. And in the United States, we have Thanksgiving. Our Thanksgiving is in the month of November. And happy Thanksgiving to the Canadians.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so that's 4 weeks from now.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving's the fourth week from now. It's the 26th.
Okay.
Of November.
So maybe we could plan something the week before our Thanksgiving, or the week before that. So.
Okay. Well, why don't I send something to the group proposing the week before Thanksgiving?
Is that the week I'm in England? I'm not sure what the dates are.
The week of the 11th, the week with Remembrance Day, and I'm gone all that week.
So the week of Monday the 16th, I think, is what Don's proposing.
Maybe the week after, isn't it, I think?
And the 11th is on a Wednesday.
Yes. I'm here Tuesday and Wednesday of the week after, which I'm around on the 17th and 18th, but I may be going to Toronto on the 19th. And because of this is quite a late call in the day, it's likely to be at a time I've left.
Okay, so let's say then maybe the 17th and 18th of November.
That works.
I'll make it work.
They'd both be really good for me, unless we wait till right towards the end of November, but that's maybe when this U.S. Thanksgiving is.
The 17th would work for me better than the 18th.
Pardon me?
The 17th?
The 17th works for me a little bit better than the 18th because...
Same here.
Although if it's the 1 o'clock Pacific time, sort of like what...
4 o'clock Eastern.
Yeah, 4 o'clock Eastern. I'm not in class on Wednesday at that time, so I get out of teaching.
So the 17th and 18th are okay for everybody at the same time?
Well, so the 17th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, does that work?
Yeah.
Let's say the same time, and then we don't have to get confused about times. The same time as today?
Yeah.
I can do the 16th or the 17th at the same time.
17th sounds like it's the... one that works best for me.
I'm on a flight on the 16th, I think, so the 17th would be much better for me.
Does anybody object to the 17th at the same time?
I'm looking.
I can rearrange office hours to make it available.
I found my appointment book, which is the first.
You know, I need to go because I got to go pick up my kids.
Yeah,
go pick up your kids.
The 17th
we can
confirm
by emails, can't we?
Yeah.
If we can just confirm on email, that'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you all for a good conversation.
I'm still here.
Okay, me too. Which date is the U.S. Thanksgiving?
It's a Thursday.
It's 26th.
November the 11th,
I think.
Oh, no, sorry, that's Veterans Day in the U.S.
It's
the 4th,
the 26th. It's the 26th of November.
Yeah. Okay. It's always... the fourth Thursday of November.
Okay. You know, it's even marked on my calendar here. Mm-hmm.
Is
Thanksgiving on there? I must have a U.S. calendar.
Is the Canadian Thanksgiving like the second Monday?
It's already happened. It happened.
It's in October.
Yes, it was several weeks ago. I've lost track now of which weekend it was.
Is it always a Monday?
It was Monday the 12th.
Of October.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Is it always a Monday?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're talking about the 17th at
the same time.
Okay.
And if that doesn't work, then maybe some other time during the week of Thanksgiving. If it's not the Thursday, is there one of the other days that would work the week of your Thanksgiving?
Well, is anybody objecting to this?
No, I thought we were doing it. Aren't we doing it the 17th?
I thought somebody was working then.
No, I think that...
they rearranged it. Okay, that's great.
So the 17th at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's perfect for me.
And we will, Michael and I will send something to the group talking about what we're going to be doing. and we will resume discussion about the same topic, about the simulation. Okay?
That's what I got out of it.
Okay. Michelle, if you have, if you wanted, it might be sensible for you to put your issues in a brief email to the group, and that would help me to understand them.
Okay. I'll see what I can manage.
Okay. And Candace, if you have issues, or if anybody has issues that they think that need to be addressed, put them in a very brief, you know, just a couple of sentences to the group. And then that'll mean that Michael and I will have to think about those in writing up our presumably a little longer discussion.
Okay, but, you know, I already know, looking at your plots, they came out with so many at the top with the ceiling effect. That isn't normal.
Now, what plot are you talking about, the one on page 8?
The one on page 12.
One on page 12.
Yeah.
Well, that's with so many at the top, the ceiling effect?
Yeah.
That's the real distribution of the pre-test value and post-test value.
Yeah.
But I understand that. But what I'm saying to you is that there are bad data in there.
No, it's because it's a Likert score. They get cut off.
Because this is a sum of I can't remember how many items there are, an average of how many items there are.
But they can't get over 7.
They can't get over 7, but it's really unusual for this many folks to get an average across my, 9 items? March, how many are in value? 11 items?
Value has the personal and professional, so it has 9.
And so that means that 9 items, all the positively worded ones, they had to have chosen a 7, and the negatively worded ones, they had to have chosen a 1, and that's unusual.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, I know that there are bad sections in here. I know that there are students who just did not participate right. It's a way to punish their instructors. And so,
it's surprising they punished their instructors by being so positive, though, isn't it?
No, because it's saying that's what they want. That's what I'm going to give them.
Oh, I see. Okay. Got it.
And the ones down at the other end, they want high value, so I'm going to give them the lowest value I can. I mean, it's incredible to me what students have done in the SATs.
Okay, I understand what you're saying.
So I'm just saying we need to really you need to carefully choose the sections that you're going to look at, and there's quite a difference in means as that part of it, I would believe, not perhaps, well, I guess the range I would believe. The range I would
maybe
believe.
Maybe what we have to do there, Candace, is just a bunch of different simulations of that distribution so that we can show that it doesn't make much difference what simulation of the distribution we use. We still get similar answers, because I suspect we will. Or we might find that if there's a lot of values clustered at the top, that things change and something goes funny, or we don't know what we'd find. But if we simulate all these different types of distributions, then we can draw some conclusions.
Okay, well, I just wanted to bring it up that there's bad data in here.
And how do you
bad from your perspective,
yes.
Bad from the sense that, you know, an internal consistency of 0.3. I would never analyze data from a section that had an internal consistency of 0.3. We've got sections that have very few people in them. We're not going to do that anymore because I'm tired of sending information back to instructors who didn't care enough to get their students to really participate. You know what I mean? When you get an N of 4 in a section.
Oh, yeah, right.
So I guess what that means is that we have to write carefully criteria for selecting sections.
That's right. That's exactly what I'm trying to suggest, and not doing a very good job.
Candace, it might make sense for you to think about that, because you're very familiar with what's right and what's not. I just looked at those numbers and thought, oh, well, that's interesting that there's quite a few people up there at the high end. but it might make sense for you to do some thinking on how can we select sections in order to get sensible statistics out of the file.
And you see, to some extent, that's not known because we don't know very much about students' attitudes towards statistics. So class size, most of our class sizes are 20 to 35, most of the sections, and yet we've got a couple of sections that have 80 students in it. Now, my gut tells me that there's a, from collecting data in the initial development phase of the stats, I was in a lot of sections. In the sections that had, that were bigger, the students were very negative, at least in their spoken behavior. I mean, even to the extent they'd ask me who they could complain to about the course. I know I'm thinking, oh my goodness, and here this instructor has allowed me in here, and so of course I'd have to burble away at something. But I don't know that because people haven't done much analysis of it. So I only know what I have experience with and that I remember because the stuff hasn't been written down and put into articles. So,
well, we have to bite the bullet and make decisions at some point. And
I know.
It just means judgments. And if the judgment is unsure, then we can do it several different ways, make several judgments and say, well, maybe it's this way or maybe it's that way.
I mean, last semester we had a class that I bet maybe 25% of the folks that were there when the post was given took it. And yet almost all of them took the pre. So if you're matching, if you're looking at matched pre to post, that's a, there clearly are differences.
Well, and that would mean that we would say that if less than, say, 50% of the class took, 50% of the people who took the pre took the post, then we throw that class out, maybe? Or some rule like that.
There would have to be a rule, but the problem is setting the, I mean, like, I feel comfortable saying, all right, if we don't have at least 20 matched pre-post, throw the section out.
Good.
But there's nothing I've ever done that proves that. Should it be 25? Maybe. I don't think it should be 15. But do you see what I'm saying? It's,
well, yeah, but we just, in this case, we just have to make judgments. Because
right.
There's nowhere else we can go.
Right.
Either we say we give up. Make some judgments.
I'm close. We give up.
So we make some judgments. That's the only alternative. And if we're unsure about a judgment, then we make several judgments, saying it might be this is the proper cutoff point, or it might be that is the proper cutoff point. Does that make sense?
Sure.
No. And so, I suggest, Candace, that you think a little bit about criteria for selecting classes from the file so that we can get statistics for those classes.
Okay. And do you want sections that have been taught by the same instructor, or do you only want in the estimates for the parameters, do you only want one section that was taught by a specific instructor?
Well, I mean, we can get finer and finer criteria, but at a certain point, we just have to say, well, you know, let's stop refining our criteria. So, I don't know, maybe all the students that were taught by one instructor, if a certain percentage of the class that took the pre also took the post, something like that.
Okay.
Use your judgment. What do you think is the best way of selecting classes and students from that SAS master file so that we can get a good set of statistics for students in an introductory course? Now, I don't think we should distinguish disciplines, like business versus psychology or something like that.
Oh, my goodness, I do.
Okay.
In a business stack class, those folks are majoring in business, and they're usually taking the class, second, third year.
Okay.
In a regular intro stack class, but I have to warn you, it's going to take me a long time because I'm going to have to look at the characteristics of these. I'm going to have to run internal consistencies. I'm going to have to do all kinds of easy but time-consuming analysis work.
Excellent. Not excellent that you have to do a lot of work, but excellent that you would think of these things. Now, remember, we don't need to get it down to the exact values here. And so we have to make judgments about how much detail we have to go into. Because I suspect that if we vary some of these things, like if we throw the business students in or we throw them out, we'll find that we get pretty well the same results. But you should try it and see what you get. And that will allow us to decide whether or not we need to differentiate between the business and the rest of them or whatever like that.
Well, I guess what I'm willing to at least try to do is determine if I were doing an analysis, what sections I would use.
Good, good.
But I don't want to compare business to a regular intro stat class. There are discipline differences, at least means. I don't know about the other parameters. I know that from work I did very early on because I collected SATS data from statistics, psych, soc, business.
Now, one thing we could do is say that we're trying to make generalizations about students in an introductory statistics course and an undergraduate introductory statistics course, and that our SATS sample is a sensible, if we throw out the graduate courses, is a sensible sample, non-statistics, of course, that they're not majoring in statistics. So our SATS sample is a reasonable sample of those courses, including the business students, and so we will just generate SATS data in our simulation that simulate that sample, maybe throwing out courses where a certain percentage, if it's a high percentage, don't do the post.
Okay.
Because we're really trying to make generalizations here that go across business and other disciplines. So it makes sense to use the full sample, throwing out graduate courses and throwing out students majoring in statistics.
You gotta go. I have to go. So I've been listening in at this point, but I'll talk to everyone, I guess, in November, if not before then.
Okay, Phil, okay. If you have any thoughts about or questions, please send an email to the group.
Okay, I will. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Phil.
Okay.
Bye. Okay, so I have to find out from Jean. I have to tell her that we've recorded this and they move it, because otherwise they move it to a different website. Otherwise, ReadyTalk charges them.
Right.
I don't know what website it goes to or how we get access to it. Do people care?
Well, it would be good for everybody to know that where it is so that they could listen to it if they want, but probably we're all busy people and we won't have a lot of time to get over it 10 or 20 times.
Okay.
Well, I listened to it. I might be able to figure out what Don said
about
games versus posts. But it might be much more efficient if he sent me a paragraph that explained what that was. Because I'd have to go through the whole hour trying to find that sentence.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so do we all think we know what we're doing?
Yes.
Next?
Yes.
Yes.
I'll keep playing with Marjorie's data. I'm having great fun.
Michelle,
oh, good.
And you might send some questions about things that are puzzling you briefly.
Yep.
And anybody, and Candace and Marge, if you have any questions, send them to the group, and I will try to address them.
Well, or whoever wants to, right?
Yeah.
But Don's being very good about keeping up with all this and sending us regular emails more than anybody else is.
Well,
we appreciate that.
It's important to me because I think that a lot of students don't get statistics, and the only way we can improve the course is to do proper designed experiments, and to do proper designed experiments, we need a methodology for doing it. So we can make a big contribution by helping people to do proper designed experiments, either telling them that, yes, change cores are okay, but perhaps not as powerful as analysis of covariance, or telling them that, no, change cores are not okay, and here's why. So I think we can make a big contribution.
Okay, good. Okay, so Michelle, I'll email you in response to the email you sent me.
Yes.
And then ask you what it is I think I want to know, or say I don't know what I want to know. Can you tell me some stuff?
Yeah, I might. I'm going to be going away Thursday of next week, so by next week I'll have finished this sort of initial play in Marjorie's data. And when I think I told you, when I talked to Marjorie on Skype, it worked really well.
Okay,
well,
good. We can try Skype
more time. I know it didn't work for us, but it, because I wasn't expecting it to work. I was ready to have a 10-minute call, and we actually kept going for 30 minutes. So I think
that's great.
I think
that's
Skype
great.
Works well for two people, and it works well if people are wearing headsets.
Well, Candace and I tried it with two people, and it didn't work. I ended up phoning her on a real phone.
Oh.
Yeah, and I've done Skype calls to Europe with no headset and talked for an hour and had no problem.
Yeah.
But this was a while ago, so I think if everybody's upgraded to the new Skype, mm-hmm. that probably will make a big difference.
Okay.
So.
Okay, we'll be in touch.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank
okay,
you.
Well, goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, I guess the meeting is adjourned.
The meeting is adjourned. Right, so I'm going to close the screen and see what happens.
Okay, thanks, Candace.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye, Marge.
Okay, close this. Okay. Yes.
Thank you.